IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we've been talking about a certain conversation that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had with his companions. And, of course, it's a conversation which has in it this saying and this sentence and statement from Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, which we have been focusing on in recent programs. But the beauty of it is that we are taking different aspects from this conversation and elaborating them. And so, of course, we have decided to focus just a little bit more on this one conversation, more than we usually do on our program, because this specific conversation is so important and is so necessary for us in our daily lives in the present time. Now, in this conversation, of course, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was asked by one of his companions about who we should listen to as a speaker and what are the repercussions of listening to that speaker. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he replies to the companion and he says, "One who listens to a speaker worships them. And if the speaker speaks on behalf of Allah, the listener has worshipped Allah. And if the speaker speaks on behalf of Shaitan and Iblis, they have worshipped Iblis." Now, we had talked about initially how what happens if a listener listens to a speaker who speaks on behalf of the Almighty Allah. We talked about that in its different dimensions. Since the last program, though, we had started to talk about the second aspect of this tradition in which Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said in the conversation that if a speaker speaks on behalf of Iblis. Now, just kind of adding to that discussion as a separate entity on today's program, of course, we find that we live in a life where certain industries promote their own, you know, messages, which are biased and prejudiced in one way or the other, via the movie industry, via the music industry, and via social media. And so we've talked about the movie industry in our previous program, which you should definitely listen to. But in this program, you know, we probably won't get to social media. We'll have to leave that for another day. But we find that the music industry, of course, a multi-million dollar industry, which encompasses the whole entire world. Now, the music industry, and again, we have to remember what we're talking about, and that is if we listen to a speaker who speaks on behalf of Shaitan. And so here, when we look overall at the mass media music industry, we find that for the most part, I mean, we could easily say 98% plus are speaking on behalf of Iblis and Shaitan. And, well, just look at the lyrics, look at the music, look at the culture that is being promoted by the music industry. Of course, you have the music industry, you know, in the English language, primarily in the modern day, centered in the United States of America. But you have smaller music industries all across the world, which are really pushing the same kind of, you know, unethical, immoral culture, you know, across the world. What is interesting and perhaps unfortunate is that the United States of America is an excellent case study for this subject, how the music industry has, you know, for all intents and purposes, molded the culture of the people, or, you know, at the least is trying to mold the culture of the people. So what kind of a culture are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the use of swear words. We're talking about promiscuity. We're talking about alcohol use and abuse. We're talking about drug use and abuse. This rap star, rock star lifestyle without any constraints and without any limits, just this insane, extravagance and luxuriousness beyond imagination, which really to a certain point is sickening. This is what is being promoted by the music industry all across the world, and mainly you can see this as a case study in the United States of America. Now, here we have to understand that this music industry, for whatever intention and whatever schemes or plots or goal is behind all this, they are definitely speaking on behalf of Shaitan. We have to be incredibly careful what we listen to, because if we listen to a speaker who is speaking on behalf of Shaitan, then we have worshipped Shaitan. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
But the history of this goes back to the Prophet himself. Imam Rida then explains in that same riwayah, according to Ibn Rustam and the Rawi of the tradition, Imam Rida then explains that, wait a second, this has happened in the past. That what is happening to myself and my son is not new. Rather, it goes back to the time of the Messenger of Allah, that when the Messenger of Allah married Maria al-Koptiya, right? She was previously a Christian from the Sudanese area, or Nubian, who then became Muslim and married the Messenger of Allah, right? She was given as a gift to the Messenger of Allah, as we know the story. But there was a problem here. Some of the wives of the Prophet, as Imam Rida explains, became very jealous of this woman. And I think what the ishara here is that they became jealous because the Prophet is giving so much attention to a dark-colored woman, or a Nubian woman, or a Sudanese woman in modern Sudan, modern terms. So, she came into the life of the Prophet with her servant, Juray. Juray was her servant. So she had a very loyal servant. So they went to their fathers, these wives went to their fathers and told their fathers, Ibrahim was not the Prophet's. Rather, Ibrahim belonged to that servant, Juray. This is as Ibn Rustam relates in Nawadir al-Mu'jizat, one of our very earliest books of hadith. And it all boiled down to issues of race again. This is what the imams are giving ishara, what they're alluding to here. That it boiled down to that she could be, that, you know, that this was all, one of the reasons why this was made easier to accuse was because of where she is from, or because of the color of her skin. Na'udhu billah. The Prophet sent a middle mu'mineen to investigate. Middle mu'mineen finds out, of course, that this is not the case. That this is absolute lie and absolute fabrication. Of course, the Prophet knew this, but he wanted to show them that, you know, look, okay, I'm sending Ali to find out. They then come back to the Prophet to ask for forgiveness, and he tells them that God's mercy shall forever be taken away from you. Forever, abada. And I don't accept your forgiveness. And Allah does not accept your tawbah.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. Across France, top unions led another day of strikes aimed at winning the revocation of a recent two-year hike to the retirement age. With President Emmanuel Macron refusing to budge, many are now demanding the movement expand into a complete general strike.
We must have a general strike to create a new system of society, as our current model allows the government and the bosses to totally ignore our needs. Everybody must get involved because everybody is affected.
Many speculate that Macron is so isolated from everyday French society that he may not understand how resentful the public mood is following one austerity measure after another since 2010.
Macron doesn't listen to us, but what's worse is that he looks down on us. He still doesn't care about all the protesting, so that's why our goal has to be to block the entire economy with a general strike. That will get his attention.
The general strike of 2019-2020 was the nation's longest labor action ever, but it ultimately failed. The strike shaved only 0.1% off of French economic growth that quarter, showing that a general strike's most powerful aspect may be its ability to shame and discredit those in power.
The biggest economic impact of striking is felt by the workers. The pre-COVID general strike failed because so many workers were just too impoverished to continue a strike that had lasted almost 2 months.
The government did all it could to stretch the general strike out, as their plan was to exhaust the strikers financially. They're using the same tactic now, and that's why we saw more than 4 months of massive protests before they even met with unions to discuss the age hike.
This spring has seen record strikes in other European nations, such as Belgium, Germany, Spain, and even the United Kingdom. Low salaries, record inflation, and perceptions that their governments refuse to democratically recognize the scope of the hardship are all consistently cited as reasons. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The right to go on strike, to withdraw one's labor over grievances with one's employer, potentially under threat in proposed legislation that gives the British government sweeping powers to clamp down on industrial action.
They say it's democratic when it's not democratic, so they're an affront to democracy with what they want on this bill. And it'll turn worker, they want to turn worker against worker, but it won't. It'll just cause confusion.
Mr. Speaker.
Formerly known as the Minimum Service Level Bill, voted on in Parliament Monday, the legislation enables the government to determine what a minimum level of service should be, with potential consequences for strikers and the unions that represent them.
The unions would face sequestration of their funds, which is obviously a serious, very serious step, and unions can't afford to go down that road. So it will effectively stop strike action in those parts of the economy, but it will also seek to scare people in other parts of the economy about what will happen to them should they take the decision to go on strike.
The freedom to form and join a union and to bargain collectively is one of the four international labor standards, standards which the UK government has signed up to.
The UK is part of the ILO and signed up to all of its conventions. So the right to strike is really a fundamental human right. It's something that we should protect and be very aware of any legislation that seeks to restrict that. And I think, you know, I think internationally people will be concerned that here in the UK we're seeking to restrict that right.
Among the sectors impacted by the legislation, health, education, transport and fire services, all of which have staged several rounds of industrial action over pay and working conditions over the past year in the face of the UK's cost of living crisis.
Strikes became common during the Industrial Revolution. The UK has recognized the right to strike since at least 1906. And the protesters and union leaders here say they're not going to allow that right to be eroded or taken away. Saeed Poreza, London.
Space.
specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians was also a child. 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing the situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons, our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbas, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Civili, Donetsk.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation.
Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force with prospect of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasim, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these potatoes under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself. Because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them. By blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting calling it not useful and a one-way monologue.
The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris. We'll be right back.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
A new study quantifies fossil fuel companies' impact on Western wildfires. The study, published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Research Letters, is the first to quantify how corporate emissions have made wildfires worse. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, the American West has always had forest fires, just not like this. Blazes are spreading further and burning longer, incinerating towns and exposing millions of people to noxious smoke. While a century of fire suppression and other land management choices contribute to the severity, climate change is a key factor fueling these fires, roughly doubling the acreage burnt over the last 40 years. A new study takes this connection one step further, making the case that a significant chunk of burnt forest, nearly 20 million acres, can be traced back to major fossil fuel companies. The study, published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Research Letters recently, is the first to quantify how corporate emissions have made wildfires worse. Experts say the new research could help advance growing efforts to take polluters to court. Carly Phillips, a co-author of the new study and a research scientist at the Science Hub for Climate Litigation at the Union of Concerned Scientists, said, "These companies should be held accountable for their fair share of the damages that they have caused. They lied and engaged in this orchestrated campaign of deception for years, and it didn't have to be this way, right?" Researchers from the Union of Concerned Scientists and the University of California, Merced, found that 37% of forests burnt across the western United States and southwestern Canada since 1986 can be linked to carbon pollution from 88 of the world's largest oil, gas, and coal companies. That group includes Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell. State-owned oil producers like Saudi Aramco and Gazprom, and cement manufacturers. Researchers considered emissions directly emitted by these companies' operations, as well as the indirect emissions from the products they sold. Since 2017, cities and states have filed around 20 lawsuits against fossil fuel companies based on state laws that prohibit deceptive advertising seeking money to adapt to the effects of climate change. The suits were set in motion by investigations showing that Exxon, Shell, and coal companies had known about the dangers of skyrocketing carbon emissions for decades, but publicly downplayed the threat. After years of delays, the Supreme Court declined to get involved in these cases last month, clearing the way for them to proceed potentially to jury trials. This study comes as spring fires scorched western Canada during an unusually hot and dry spring, with about 1 million acres burning across the province of Alberta. An early heat wave pushed temperatures above 90 degrees in parts of the typically temperate Pacific Northwest, with Seattle and Portland breaking heat records at least 3 days in a row. The same heat dome is expected to fan the flames of nearly 90 fires burning across Alberta. It's hard to draw a direct line between global warming and wildfires, but recent advances in attribution science, the field that identifies climate change's role in heat waves, droughts, rising seas, and other phenomena, have made it possible to quantify its effect on fires. The new study relies on a key risk factor called the vapor pressure deficit, a measure of how thirsty the atmosphere is. Hotter temperatures cause moisture to be pulled out of vegetation, turning forests into tinderboxes just waiting for a spark. To figure out how companies' emissions contributed to fire danger conditions in the West, researchers built on a previous study that linked emissions from 88 big fossil fuel producers to rising temperatures. Then they compared two models of how dry forests would be under different climate scenarios, one modeled on the real world and the other excluding the emissions associated with the 88 companies. The major contribution of this study is to connect all of the dots between specific sources of human-related carbon emissions and recent increases in forest fire activity, said Philip Higora, a professor of fire ecology at the University of Montana who was not involved in the study. Most of the links have been well known for a long time, but this is the first study to connect the dots quantitatively. Exxon and BP did not respond to Grice's request to comment in time for publication. Jessica Wentz, a fellow at Columbia University's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law, thought the findings could be used to support existing lawsuits or provide the impetus for other local governments or to file their own. Wentz said the research might be relevant to a case in Colorado, where the city and county of Boulder, along with San Miguel County, sued Sunker Energy and ExxonMobil, seeking millions of dollars to update their infrastructure to withstand climate change. Wentz said, "That's the one lawsuit where wildfire-related damages are forefront and central." Translating the research to a specific court case could prove thorny, though. The study looked at a large region, the whole North American West, and the aggregate of 88 companies' emissions. It's possible that attorneys could use the new research to calculate wildfire risk over a smaller area, say Boulder County, but it would require some extrapolation. For calculating damages, a court might want to see a more fine-grained analysis, Wentz said. It's really a totally open question of how courts will look at the evidence and just how granular will plaintiffs need to be in terms of providing scientific data to support their claims. We just don't know yet, he said. In a way, the long delays in these climate court cases have actually given some ammunition to cities and states looking to hold fossil fuel companies accountable. The extra time has allowed the science of climate attribution to mature. so that if these cases end up going to trials, cities and states have more evidence to support their case. It's a sort of weird silver lining, Wendt said.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Kamerayi that he says in Farsi, Tuhide kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, Al-Muallim. This program is about the life and the works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars and ulama all across the world. During the history of Islam, I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Fadai, salam alaikum, welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, salam alaikum to you.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding scholars of 14th century Hijra, Marja Taqlid, a mufassir of the Holy Quran, the author of Mawahib al-Rahman fi Tafsir al-Quran, Sayyid Abdul Ala Musavi Sabzevari. Before getting to his scholarly life and socio-political life, let's be more familiar with his early life. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatullah Sayyid Abdul Ala Musavi Sabzevari was born in 1328 of Hijri Qamari. He lived in Sabzawar, which is one of the cities of the Khorasan province.
Yes.
But he then moved to Iraq and in Najaf, Ashraf, and finally he died there and he was buried there. So among his teachers, there are really great scholars among his teachers like Aqadhi Iraqi, Muhammad Hussein Naini, Muhammad Hussein Gharawi Isfahani, Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, Sheikh Abbas Qummi. So each one of them are among the very great scholars of Tashayyu. Okay. And of course, among his works that he has authored in his life is Mawahib al-Rahman fi Tafsir al-Quran and Muhadhib al-Ahkam fi Bayan al-Halal wal-Haram, Tahdhib al-Usul, and many Ulubab al-Ma'arif. These are some of the actually works which are written by these great scholars.
That's right.
In his life, of course, the socio-political aspect of his life is also important, that he supported the Islamic revolution in Iran.
Yes.
And of course, he actually socially he was very much again active, building many masajid and rebuilding, or we can say repairing, Masjid al-Sahla and Masjid al-Kufa, and sending his representatives to Europe, to America and the Arab, let's say, countries to propagate or to preach the Islamic teachings, and also to collect their, let's say, charities for rebuilding kind of masajid in the city of Najaf al-Ashraf.
We will get to the book Mawahib al-Rahman fi Tafsir al-Quran, his most outstanding work. But before that, let's be a little bit conservative, socio-political life. As Sheikh Rouhani said, Sheikh Fadai, his defense for the late Imam Khomeini, and also his presence, we can say, in Intifada al-Sha'baniya in the country Iraq, shows that as a marja, he was sociopolitically also very much active. Give us some information about this aspect of the late Sabzawari's life.
In the name of God, the compassion, the merciful, Ayatollah Sayyid Abdul Ala Sabzawari was active in both countries, Iran and Iraq. Of course, he lived in Iraq most of his life, but he considers the political actions in Iran so important. For example, he supported the Islamic Revolution, and in the referendum that we had after the beginning of revolution, yes, he sent a message to Iran and supported this Islamic Revolution, supported the vote of yes for this referendum, which was an invitation for people in Iran to vote for this Islamic Revolution and referendum. And in Iraq, as we know, the Intifada Sha'baniya, he disagreed. The government of Iraq at that time was not a correct government. It was a corrupted regime. Although it was called Islamic regime, but the name doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. At that time, the regime in Iraq was not beside Muslims and Shia. And in the year 1991, in Sha'ban, they started a revolution against that regime. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, it was successful. They could overcome more than 14 provinces of Iraq, but because of some corruptions, because some of the some people in Iraq and maybe some groups like Mujahideen, of course, they were Iranian.
MKE. But,
they were active in Iraq. One of the reasons that this revolution was not successful was active actions that they did at that time. Of course,
you
they
mean
had
against
a lot of,
the Basque regime?
Against,
that's right.
You know, that Mujahideen, they were against this Intifada, this revolution.
And as they were against the Islamic
Revolution,
the post events of Islamic Revolution.
Always they were against the side of Haq. At that revolution, they started very good, but they had a lot of martyrs, and a lot of people had to leave their houses. And this was not successful at the end. Mm-hmm. But it was a beginning point to free Iraq after some years. Maybe even in Iran, in our revolution led by Imam Khomeini, mm-hmm, was not the first point, the beginning point. Some scholars, great scholars like Ayatollah Mudarris, like before that Nawab Safavi, they tried a lot, and our revolution was the conclusion of their tries. Like this was a beginning point. They tried a lot, but one of the reasons that this action, this intifada, couldn't reach its final point was that people were not united. Mm-hmm. Although they had a good leader like Ayatollah Sabzevari, they were not united. Maybe Sunni and Shia were not united as well, and some other people. But anyway, the point which is important is that a great Islamic scholar considered this as his duty, mm-hmm, to lead a revolution against the side of battle. You know, Hosea is not just sitting in house and just thinking about fiqh and usul, writing books and teaching students. No, our religion is a plan of life.
Yes.
And religion has two parts, two sides, personal and social aspect. And the one who is in charge of this religion should be in charge of both social and personal aspects of life.
That's right.
So because of that, he did his job very well, although he could not be successful at the end. But he did his best. And
we know that the military power at that time was in the hands of the Basque regime.
Yes.
And also they attacked, you know, the holy shrines and the holy sites of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Hazrat Abul Fazl.
And they ruined a lot of mosques and Hussein in Iraq at that time.
Still, the pictures are over there. Still nowadays, when you go, for example, to the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the traces of the bullets of Saddam Hussein are kept over there, okay? That, see, one day, for example, Saddam Hussein attacked the holy shrine of Imam
Although
Hussein.
He called himself son of the Ahlul Bayt, Saddam.
Of course he was. Okay, that's right. Unfortunately, you see the walls and the domes and the minarets, we can say, were demolished in that event. But as you said, it was a nice counterattack against Saddam Hussein by these intifadas.
And even it is mentioned in history that the regime of Baas closed the doors of holy shrines
yes.
in Najaf and Karbala
yes.
for 6 months
yes.
To punish Shia people.
Yes.
That why did you start this revolution?
Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
That's all right. Okay, let's get to Mawahib al-Rahman. Maybe one of the most voluminous tafasir of the Holy Quran of contemporary era of the Muslim world, because it has been, authored in 30 volumes, 12 of which are published right to now in Arabic language. So it seems to be a great work, Sheikh Rouhani.
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, Mawahib al-Rahman fi Tafsir al-Quran, written by late Sabzawari, rahmatullahi alayhi, was one of the voluminous, tafasir or interpretations of the Holy Quran. Yes, 12 volumes of it were published, but the rest are not yet published. But you see that Tafsir al-Quran in, different eras or different times, we need actually the tafsir, the new tafsir or the new interpretation of the Holy Quran, as it is, it has been done by many of the scholars throughout the history of Islam. That is why at the time of this, Ayatollah Sabzawari, he might felt need to actually write an interpretation on
yes.
the Holy Quran. That's why, of course, he had written this voluminous tafsir of mm-hmm. the Holy Quran.
Okay,
but
right.
it was not only his, one of his works was this tafsir, but
yes.
of course he had lots of other works and ahkam, like Mahdhab al-Ahkam fi Bayan
yes.
al-Halali wal-Haram, which is a jurisprudential imami kind of work. And of course, it is also in 3 volumes, this,
yeah.
Jurisprudential book.
That's right.
And also in Ilm al-Usul, he had Tahdhib al-Usul, which is a complete kind of introductory kind of
okay.
Studies about Usul.
Mm-hmm.
And also in Ilm al-Kalam or Aqa'id, the Islamic beliefs, he has written Lubab al-Ma'arif, of course. They are all in Arabic, and
yes.
They were written by this great scholar. And it shows that he were really a very, great scholar.
Yes.
His scholarly life was really fruitful
mm-hmm.
of these different kind of works in
okay.
fiqh, in usul, in tafsir, in kalam. And, of course, it shows that how active he had been in his life.
That's right.
And how fruitful was his
okay.
life.
Was his method of research in Mawahib al-Rahman very much outstanding and different from the previous tafasir or of his own generation?
You know, at that time, usually interpreter used to just study riwayats
mm-hmm.
to interpret Quran. As we call it, tafsir al-riwayi,
yes.
and we have tafsir al-ijtihadi.
Yes.
You know, riwayi is based on riwayas. And some interpreters, some scholars believe that we cannot understand Quran correctly. The only ones who can understand it is Ahlul Bayt. Just
yes.
that 14
mm-hmm.
figures can understand it. Other people cannot. They don't have this ability. But we have other sides. Some Islamic scholars believe that, no, Quran is our plan of life. And it is mentioned that it was sent for people to understand it. And we have a lot of verses in Quran which order people to think and ponder on the verses of Quran. They believe if we are ordered to ponder on the verses, it means that we can understand. So there is a gate called ijtihad, to think about that.
Yes.
In Mawahib al-Rahman, we can see that this author used ijtihad to interpret the Quran. At that time, you know, usually when we talk about Tafsir al-Ijtihadi, we think that it is a very modern kind of tafsir, maybe Allama Tabatabai started. No, it's not like that.
Okay.
At that time, although the common kinds of tafsir was Rabai, he used the method of Ijtihadi in his tafsir. Although in Ijtihadi method, we use other verses and Rivayat as well.
Yes.
But to conclude and to make all the parts like a puzzle, we use our think.
Yes.
So, of course, that thing should be based on our Islamic point of view.
Yes.
Not something that is
not
our taste.
Not something personal.
Yeah,
or,
not personal. Yeah, when we say Ijtihad, it doesn't mean my personal taste.
Mm-hmm.
No. First, I should live in the atmosphere of Islam and get close to the Islamic viewpoints.
Yes.
And it takes a lot of time, maybe 30, maybe 40 years of our age should be used in this way. After the one is a very great expert scholar in Islam, he can start to use his ijtihad.
That's all right.
Combining verses and rivaya and aql.
Okay.
The combination of three points. This is one of the great points in this tafsir that was Ijtihad. And also in this tafsir, the author tries to answer a lot of questions. We call it Shubha.
Yes.
A lot of questions about Islam.
The doubts and ambiguities.
The doubts, yes. Okay. Yeah, you know, he was not just careful about just interpreting the verses. No. He checked what kind of doubt is can exist here in this verse. So he answered all these doubters.
Yes.
So it can be useful even in our social life here.
That's all right. Thank you very much. The original handwritten volume of this book is kept in his own personal library in the holy city of Najaf. Of course, it was printed and reprinted both in Najaf and Beirut again. And as I said, out of 30 volumes, 12 are published up to now. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Sayyid Abdul Ala Sabzawari. He passed away on Safar 27th, 1414, according to the Hijra calendar. Some people believe that he was martyred or poisoned by the Ba'ath regime on that time, so his cause of this was not a natural death. The no burial procession was done because Saddam has banned putting any burial procession for the ulama on that time. And he was buried in the mosque that he taught, and he prayed over there, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Sayyid Abdullah Alai Sabzawari, the author of Mawahib al-Rahman fi Tafsir al-Quran. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, Al-Muallim. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.